Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Dr. Mark Farber and Ira Harris. Dr. Farber is the editor and publisher of a widely read monthly investment newsletter, The Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report, which highlights unusual investment opportunities, and he's the author of several books. Ira is a hedge fund manager, a global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He's also served as CME director for several years. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, and it's again another great honor to be with Dr. Farber.
It's my pleasure.
Yep.
Great. I thought we begin, Dr. Farber, with your thoughts on the current economic environment. What do you make of the COVID situation, just in general, and also economic effects?
Well, I think to answer these numerous questions would take a very long time. So I'll break it down into essentially first talking about the economy very briefly. Obviously, this is visible to everyone who lives and works or has been working that the economy is way down from the peak in the second, third quarter of 2019. So economically, we're not doing well. What is unusual about this recession that we are facing is that the stock market is essentially in the U.S. at the new high. Overseas, not most overseas markets are down 10-20% or more. Also unusual in this recession is that traditionally in recessions, two things happen. A, the stock market goes down because corporate earnings come down, and B, the trade deficit of the U.S. narrows because as consumption diminishes, less imports come in, and so the deficit is lower than before. But in this recession, actually, the trade deficit has been widening because of the money handouts of the governments. The government gives money to people, and in terms of subsidies to corporations, and they go and buy stuff, but obviously the stuff they buy has not been made in the U.S., so it has to be imported. So if you look at what Trump said about making America great again, meaning that it becomes less dependent on imports, actually the U.S. is more dependent on imports than ever before. So this is unusual in this recovery, and the question is obviously, how do you justify stocks at the current level? Well, you justify stocks at the current level with money printing. The Fed's balance sheet has expanded dramatically by over $3 trillion over the last 12 months and through stimulus packages. But is that really economic growth? Is it sustainable? That is a big question.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, Dr. Farber, as usual, raises two very poignant points. And Dr. Farber and I were together. I think we're both in agreement that we were going to see some type of inflation scenario. And we had talked about which stocks, Richard, when you asked us, we were looking for, and we like the ag sector, which we're starting to perform very well after we had that podcast, but then COVID hit, and we know that commodity prices in March and April absolutely collapsed. The Bloomberg commodity index dropped from 81 down to 59, a precipitous drop, but of course well earned because nobody knew what was really going to take place. Were we going to go into a total demand shock where demand was going to fly, was just going to fall off the cliff, which it did. And of course, the market got ahead of itself. But now we're starting to reassert. It's interesting that as we're talking now, the copper, which had gotten hammered last week in anticipation, well, maybe I'm not going to get a deal done. Things were slowing. The copper's approaching back to its highs again. It's up 6 cents today. It was up. So it's, you know, performed very well. I think Dr. Robert's points are so well taken. And it actually picks up on the article that, of course, has been making the rounds. There was one in the FT by Steve Roach yesterday. But that article has really been out for almost 3 weeks now, talking about a 35% decline coming in the dollar. And a lot of it, a lot of Roach's analysis falls out from Dr. Favre, which is, why is this trade deficit as well as the current account deficit turning so bad in a time when we're in a recession that, it, as Dr. Favre talks about, should rightly be improving? So I think we know the answer, which is the Fed has been ultra stimulative, but it's not just the stimulus at this time with the Fed. It was, of course, the original $3 trillion COVID relief package is one. We're waiting on another one. In fact, maybe we'll hear something as we're sitting here, because it goes back and forth in the Twitter world. But I think those points are dead right on target. But with all of this, will we give rise to an inflationary stimulus, which is what the Fed is promoting? I mean, Powell was adamant. So I'll stop there and we'll continue.
Go ahead, Dr. Farber. Did you want to mention something?
Well, I think you should look at the price stability as a central bank and not inflation. And who is to say that you can peg inflation at 1%, 2%, or 3%? Economic development is a dynamic process. So if you look at long-term cycles, we had cycles during which inflation accelerated. And by inflation, I'd like to make a distinction. Over the last 20, 30 years, we had a lot of asset inflation. In other words, asset prices went up. We didn't have high consumer price inflation, whereby the cost of living, if that was measured properly, the cost of living for a family of two grown-ups and two children has gone up dramatically if everything is included, including education, health care, insurance costs, and so forth and so on. So the figures that the central banks are using are irrelevant, in my opinion, for the typical household. Number two, we had this asset inflation I was speaking before, and we had essentially, especially after 2008 and in some cases 2011, we had commodities deflation again. We had an inflationary bout for commodity prices, including precious metals, 1999, 2003, to the peak for oil in 2008 and for other commodities around 2011 and so forth. So, but now what is interesting is that, IRA, as Ira said, we had this collapse in commodities, in the commodities indices after the COVID-19 crisis began, because people thought the economy is going to collapse, which it has in many sectors, I can tell you. In the travel industry, it's a complete disaster. In the hotel industry, ditto. And in the restaurant industry as well. But we had recently some pickup in some commodities that were very dramatic, including lumber has shot up. We had a significant increase recently, which is unusual given that global trade isn't growing. We had a huge increase in the Baltic Dry Index, is more than doubled. And we had just in the last, say, 2 weeks, a sharp rise in soybean and wheat prices. And in my opinion, this is very significant, because Ira mentioned earlier the price of copper that had been going up. The price of copper and the price of interest rates correlates. But what has happened this year is that interest rates went down on the, say, the 10-year treasury, and the price of copper went up. So there's this huge divergence. And I think one way or the other, it will be close. Either copper prices will collapse and adjust to the decline in interest rates, or suddenly interest rates could shoot up. That is really the threat to the whole equation of the Federal Reserve and all their academics, that even though we have interventions, which I rather call manipulation by the Federal Reserve, they are manipulating the markets, they're not just intervening, that despite the manipulation to keep interest rates down, that interest rates could increase. And as Ira pointed out, that the consumer price inflation could start to go up. And then we need to analyze what will the Fed do. I suppose they will do nothing. They will argue, well, we didn't print enough money. That's why interest rates are going up. So they'll print even more. And then you can get into a vicious circle of weak dollar, rising consumer prices, rising interest rates.
And could the acceleration of yield curve control also exacerbate, make the situation worse overall in terms of, you know, the Federal Reserve using currency or sacrificing currency to be able to keep the interest rates on the long end of the yield curve low?
That they can maybe manage, but as you say, at the cost of a weaker dollar and the loss of confidence in the dollar, and probably a loss of confidence in the dollar as a reserve currency. You know, if that goes, then obviously the US will be no longer in the favorable position it has been since Bretton Woods, where the US dollar essentially became an official reserve currency. So that could happen. And I mean, I'm very bearish about the dollar long term. The question, are the other currencies any better? This year, the euro is up 5% against the dollar. But you look at emerging market currencies, Brazil, the Brazilian real is down 28%, the Turkish lira more than 22%, the Russian ruble 20%, and so forth. So the US dollar has been relatively stable against most currencies, or actually has strengthened. It's weakened slightly, surprisingly, to all the China bashers, who are, of course, quite ignorant about the economic and financial position of the of China. But say the Kylie Bass of this world and the Pompeos of this world, who kind of hate China for what reason, we don't know. But anyway, these China bashers were all starting funds to short the yuan or RMB and the Hong Kong dollar. And these two currencies are actually up moderately against the US dollar this year.
Are your thoughts?
Well, we certainly have traveled some interesting places, and I'm glad that Dr. Faber brought up the soybeans, because it's, and with the Baltic freight, so, and with the appreciating yuan. So, I mean, his deep knowledge of China. So, I mean, it just seems from everything that we're seeing, especially coming into the U.S. harvest, we're right in the middle of it, maybe towards getting towards the tail end of it, that the Chinese are must be buying massive amounts of grain, in fear of being caught short of food. So, I mean, because it's inexplicable any other way, because here's what we also do know, and Dr. Faber brings up the Brazilian real. If I price soybeans into now, I believe the Brazilians are the world's largest soybean producer. But in terms of real, Brazilian farmers are receiving record high prices for soybeans based in reals. So when they get their dollars and they change them into reals, they're receiving mass amounts of money. So we can, I know that there's the talk of drought. We're in a little bit of a drought in Brazil right now, but Brazilian farmers will be planting, and the Chinese certainly know that, and you know, trying to produce a big crop, and yet they're still out there buying. So I think that is significant, very significant. And I think that Dr. Faber is right also. And as he talks about the euro, I also look at the yen, and in the world that we live in, and I saw an article the other day that the People's Bank of China was buying quite a bit of JGBs, which was interesting because everybody looks at the Japanese and goes, well, their interest rates are zero. Well, interest rates at zero really don't mean much in today's world when Europe is at the Bund trades at negative 50 basis points, the French at negative 25, and the Dutch. So we're in there. And I look at the yen and I go, the yen is probably on a real yield basis the best currency right now of the major currencies, because at least their real yields are probably zero, whereas the United States is certainly negative and significantly negative, and Europe is significantly negative. So when I look out and I go, what currencies would at least would I want to, if I was holding something, what would I want to own? If I'm a Japanese investor, I'm certainly not going looking for nominal yields around the world because I'm better off at home. Maybe not from a corporate earnings standpoint, although that may change under Suga. So we'll see. But I think that there are all these movements afoot, and the Chinese currency is interesting. Now, is the Chinese currency being allowed to appreciate because the Chinese are going to shift some of their growth from exports to domestic base? Because if you're moving to domestic consumption, you certainly want a stronger currency because you want to be able to enrich your consumers, and you don't want the currency to go down. So I mean, these things are all out there, and I hope we'll get into these deeper.
And what about Dr. Faber on your thoughts for other inflation factors, like the potential of indebted Western world governments in response to the COVID challenges to use MMT, modern monetary theory, for driving infrastructure projects and things of that nature? What are your thoughts on the effect of that on the economy and in the financial markets?
Well, MMT is nothing new, so it's not the modern monetary theory. And B, it basically entails giving out money to people, in other words, having a basic, universal basic income, UBI. So you send home to each household $1,000, and under some conditions, it might be actually desirable. The scenario under which it would be desirable is that you send to each household $1,000 a month or $2,000 or whatever. But then you stop all the other subsidies and social security and healthcare benefits. And it's not in addition to that. In addition to what you already get is actually negative. And I think that nowadays, because interest rates are next to zero, or as Ira pointed out, you know, in Switzerland, I can buy a 10-year Swiss franc bond, government bond. I pay today 110, and in 10 years, I get 100 back. It's a zero coupon bond, so I don't get any income in between. So over 10 years, I lose 10%. That is essentially an expropriation of money by the government. In the Swiss constitution, expropriation is actually excluded. In reality, when you have negative interest rates, it's an expropriation, period. Anyway, we have this situation. So people are driven in all kinds of investments. And I'm not keen on any currency. But I look upon precious metals as currencies. And I find them relatively attractive compared to the yen and compared to the euro and compared to the Swiss franc and so forth. So for cash requirements, I think that people should own some precious metals.
And Ira, your thoughts?
Well, I certainly agree with that. And, you know, we haven't really discussed the bond markets, you know, and a lot of people, you know, I'm always scratching my head as to anybody be buying a long-term bond, you know, and we've had this discussion, Richard, you and I, with David Rosenberg and with Lacey Hunt, and they've certainly, bondholders on the long end have been rewarded this year, but I think that's the fallout from COVID. But in regards to the currency, you know, when we discuss the currencies, to me, if the dollar goes higher, it's an indication that Powell and the Fed have failed at what they're trying to do, which is, of course, to try to, in the classic element of financial repression throughout history, and I can go back and read the works of Fernand Braudel and people who recorded the Middle Ages and what went on, the depreciation of currency is, you know, a time-honored mechanism of wiping out your debts. And when I listened to Powell yesterday, you know, Richard, I've been on this, and I think Dr. Faber will probably agree with me, is that the Fed is now a social justice ministry, because over and over, whenever you talk about that people lost jobs through no fault of their own, and Powell yesterday was even more explicit than he has. He didn't use that phrase, but he talked about those who have been harmed greatly by the whole COVID pandemic. And I don't know anymore, when the Fed says that they'll pull back from the aggressive monetary stimulus, they'll know it because they'll see growth. But if your outcome is to return minorities, women, black, Hispanics, to their previous high watermark in 2019, actually the beginning of 2020. I don't know when you can deem yourself successful, and at what level then do you start to remove the stimulus and start raising interest rates? Because, and that's why that pushes me to the precious metals, because that is just, that's a goal that, really, I can't wrap my head around. Not that I disagree with the moral positioning of that. No, of course you want people to be working and productive, but I just cannot come to grips with that's the role of the central bank. The central bank is, you know, they've taken on, I don't know how many mandates they've taken for themselves now, but it does leave me wondering where do I go to at least protect the value of my wealth, and especially because every central bank, they just follow each other. When you they're all the same. It's like they went to a cookie cutter. There's a page somewhere that exists, and they all just print it out and then just read it because they're so similar. And I've never seen that in my life. I long for the days of the Bundesbank and Otto Pohl, when there were people who were really responsible, even the Swiss, as Dr. Fowler. I mean, it's very difficult reading Thomas Jordan's, because he sounds just like everybody else. And that is so unlike the Swiss. The only way he doesn't is that he's readily to intervene to weaken the currency when they're, and nobody ostensibly says that, but they all imply it. So I'm left with in the metals market too. And, just because it's about what is the role of central banks in today's world. They've taken on a lot, and I don't know how they extricate themselves.
And Dr. Faber, what about other commodities, like in the energy area, fossil fuel based commodities and the in the agricultural meat markets, given that there's the World Economic Forum Great Reset Initiative that is looking at diminishing those markets. So what are your thoughts on that for those commodity markets?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to make a comment to what Ira said about the central banks having become kind of ministries of social justice. I mean, central banks, in my view, have failed at everything they ever touched. They created money out of nothing. They financed wars. Without central banks, there would be much less international conflicts. There would be a smaller government than there is. We would be less indebted. In the 19th century, without central banks, all economies grew at a faster pace than in the 20th century. So I think that there has been a massive failure. And if you talk about social justice, I know several American Federal Reserve members said earlier this year, well, we have to now start looking at reducing the wealth inequality. But what has happened with the money printing is that the typical household in America is suffering. The small businessman that owns a hairdresser salon, a tattoo shop, a restaurant, a coffee shop, a bar, a laundry shop, all these businesses are suffering. And the richest people in America, the largest shareholders of companies like Amazon and Zoom and Google and God knows what, they've all become meaningfully richer as a result of the response of the government to COVID-19. This is a complete joke of the central bank to think that they are now also the minister of social justice. That is unbelievable. Number two, did I hear well that you mentioned Fernand Braudel? Ira?
I'm sorry, can you repeat? I'm sorry, Mark. I need to hear
did I hear well that you mentioned the historian Fernand Braudel?
Yes, yes, you did. I've read it.
Yes, I'm glad that an American Canadian would mention that, because most people don't know what a great historian he was. And he's written about capitalism and the Mediterranean and so forth. These are very valuable books about the emergence of the capitalistic system that drove economic growth in the Western world and drove technology and progress, which never happened in other regions of the world. So this is a very important, actually, there are three books that he's written. And right. Interestingly, he wrote them from memory when he was in jail, because he was Jewish, so he was jailed by the Gestapo or whoever it was in France. But these are very valuable books. So this is something I would definitely, as someone who is interested in history, acquire.
Yes.
But coming back, I mean, I beg your pardon?
Yeah, you know, and then there are a couple. Well, he's dead now, but Giovanni Arrighi and even Emmanuel Wallerstein, some people may not like Emmanuel Wallerstein's politics, but they have certainly picked up. In fact, Wallerstein, I believe, had founded a journal called The Review that was discussing. I used to get them in the 90s, was discussing and critiquing Braudel's work, but it was phenomenal. And I just gave to a young student my three volumes of Braudel's work, because I said, here, these will do you. Read these, because nobody else will ever give them to you. So he took them.
Yes. In the U.S., it's not widely read, but they are monumental historical works. A anyway, the issue here is, you know, how to protect yourself from the madness of central bankers. Actually, the central bankers are or have become the worst kind of central planners. Because you understand, under Stalin or under Mao, central planning was the state planning for economic activity. It led to a complete disaster. But they had the tools to essentially guide or command, that's the command economy, production and consumption and so forth and so on. It led to horrible misery among people, less freedom, and of course, much lower standards of living. I'm mentioning this because so many young people think the government should do this and the government should do that, and that the government should do more than it's doing currently. In an extreme case, the government does everything. And I visited Czechoslovakia in the 60s already, when I was ski racing. And I went the first time to Russia in 1981 and to China in 78 and to Vietnam in 1989. I can tell you, all socialist, communist countries, their standards of living were miles behind what we have. In Russia, I went to markets. You could buy either rotten tomatoes and rotten apples, and there were lines of people buying these rotten fruits and vegetables because there was nothing else to eat. This is a merit of the capitalistic system with all its disadvantages, that never before have so many people in the world had a decent standard of living. Not all, but the poverty rate has come down. And I can tell you, of the billions of people that lived under socialist policies and communism, like in India, China, Russia, and so forth, all of them today live better than 20, 30 years ago. I'm not sure that this would apply to Western Europe and the US, but people today live better than 20 to 30 years ago. It wouldn't seem to me to be the case, but in the emerging world where they adopted capitalism with all its unfavorable side effects like wealth inequality going up, the average household is much better off.
Could we see brain drain and wealth drain happen, you know, based on your historical perspective, Dr. Farber, given like exodus from cities, people moving to other countries, jurisdictions, where they may be more free, you know, from their living patterns? Like you have a lot of people going to different countries that are receiving them to be able to live and work, say for 1 year, different countries. What are your thoughts on that? Especially if there's a move, you know, towards the type of governments that you're mentioning.
Well, I think it's important to understand we have a new economy where you can essentially buy any kind of stuff online, and that can be delivered to you, to your house efficiently. And you have an economy where, I don't know where you are sitting and Ira are sitting, but here we are talking. We could also be talking on video. And I'm in Thailand and you are in Canada or wherever. So we can be, for our business, located anywhere in the world. I have Bloomberg. I have the quotes at the same time than somebody else. I can essentially do my business as well as when I lived in Hong Kong. I still have an office there, but I don't need to be there. So I think it's a new world where the communication revolution and also the efficient transportation of goods has allowed people to be anywhere in the world. So there is this trend, and I think this will continue, and this will have a very negative impact long term on the value of commercial real estate in city centers. I think people will prefer to live in the countryside. Also in city centers, if there is a lockdown, and even though you have a small house in the city and the backyard, if there's a lockdown, you're not even allowed to go to your backyard to have a smoke. The neighbor, he will call the police. He suddenly become a policeman as well. So I think people will go to the countryside because they will say, well, I have some disadvantages in the countryside, but I have A, not to cope with people throwing stones at the shops next to the building I'm living in or into my windows, or not attacking me physically with baseball bats. So I prefer to live in the countryside, and this aspect of security is also valid for my children. Number two, you talked about the brain drain. I just read an article, and I agree 100% with it, except the tone was a bit misplaced. It said that to be an expatriate in Asia is no longer so great as it was 30, 40 years ago. Well, the thing is this. When I went to Asia in 73, I was something a little bit special, not because I'm special, but I had some knowledge that local people didn't have. I had been taught I had a PhD in economics and Chinese value education more than Western people. And number two, I had been in New York working for an investment bank. Ira may remember White Weld and Company.
Sure.
And then I joined Drexel Burnham. But anyway, I had something to offer to people in Asia in terms of knowledge, which they didn't have. Nowadays, a young Chinese, he knows more about Wall Street than maybe a young Westerner, because the young Chinese has worked very hard. Last night, after I finished my work, usually around 3-4 in the morning, I like to watch or listen to music. Yesterday, I was watching Lang Lang, the Chinese pianist. I mean, he exaggerates a little bit, but he's a great pianist, and he plays Western music. There are not many people in the world that play perfect Western classical music. But in China, lots of them do, a lot. So I think that the brain drain has already happened. And I wrote recently about the transfer of technology. We have to realize, you know, technology has been transferred from one civilization to another. The Americans in the 19th century, they stole most of the technology in terms of industrial manufacturing from Britain. They had spies that went to Britain to make designs of British machinery. And there were English people that went to America with the knowledge of these technologies, and they set up their businesses in America. So there has been a transfer of technology in the 19th century from Europe to America, and now there is from America to China. If you build an Apple assembly plant in China, it's natural that some of the technology will be shown to the Chinese who work in that factory. Plus, if you go to American university, maybe a third of the students in science and engineering are Chinese. China has 8 times more students that study engineering, mathematics, technology, and so forth than the U.S. annually. So, of course, in many sectors of industry and of technology, the Chinese are already way ahead of Western Europe and the U.S.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
And the same for India. You go to India, all you need is one genius per million. And in India, you have a thousand geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
So,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I love it because I have that discussion with people because Dr. Faber talks about the theft of technology by the early U.S., you know, his Professor Douglas Irwin in his book on a wonderful book on clashing over titled Clashing Over Commerce, in which he gives you an entire history of tariffs with the U.S. And he talks about Sam Slater, who came from Britain and built and had the knowledge of how to build the power loom, which really made.
Yes, exactly.
New
He's
England.
A vivid example.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it goes on. And yeah, I have no, I don't have a shoulder for U.S. corporations to cry on because I can go back 20 years and the discussion was 25 years. They wanted to be in China so bad. They knew what the rules were about partnering,
yes,
the amount of technology, because I was always amazed. And there was a very vibrant discussion in the late 90s about Boeing. Is Boeing going to go over there and build aircrafts? Because what the Chinese were demanding in order for them to set up shop was that they would have to share the technology. And then it was only a matter of time before the Chinese started building commercial aircraft. Because they already, of course, knew how to build military aircraft. So, I mean, this is all part of the global process. And right now, we're really in the throes of it. Because if we go back to certainly the times of Burdell, as long as we talked about it, and others, when global capital is allowed to march around unimpeded, you have these things. Because really what it is an arbitrage of labor costs. Mm-hmm. And in today's world, as Dr. Faber points out, because of the advances in communication and transportation, it's easier than ever. So, I mean, that's where we're sitting now. There's some pushback as Trump came in and started pushing back. But the elements have certainly been unleashed. And I don't think you can put – well, of course, you could always put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak. But we have to learn how to live with it and adapt to it and make better use of it. And I've had the pleasure of lecturing to at many different universities to finance classes. And University of Illinois under Kevin Waspy, I would be there. And there were many Chinese students in the upper level of finance class. And every time I would leave a class, be it there, be it at Northwestern, my first response was always how engaging the Chinese students were, even though their language, you know, it's not perfect. But they kept coming at you with questions and were really engaging. And it made teaching them really wonderful because that's, to me, the best way to teach is to engage. And they were head and shoulders above their classmates who were educated in America who just, you know, they sat there and took notes. They engaged. They wanted to know. And I said some things that were not necessarily favorable. And they would engage me with that and then say, yeah, that's a fair point. So, I mean, it's education, which is always the key to any society advancing and changing, certainly favors the Asian world right now.
Exactly. Any final thoughts, Dr. Faber?
Well, I mean, I think... people always ask what is a safe investment. I don't think that there is a safe investment anymore. Because when I grew up in the 50s, safe was to have money in the bank. There was an expression, just safe as money in the bank. but that is no longer so safe because the purchasing power of paper money is going downhill. And we have a capitalistic system that has been corrupted by an institution like the Federal Reserve that intervenes or manipulates markets and distorts very badly the price mechanism. For the market economy, for the capitalistic system to function well, you need price discovery. But that has been distorted by the manipulations of the Federal Reserve. And then we have also, in 1913, I've seen statistics, and these are statistics that are correct. No European country, and not even the US, had total government spending, that is federal, state, and municipal spending, that was more than 11% of the economy. Today, most countries in Western Europe have government spending that is over 50% of the economy. In the US, it's not as bad, but probably if it was measured statistically better, it would be close to 50%. So the point is, the larger the government is within the economy, the slower economic growth will be, and the less standards of living will improve. Actually, I feel to some extent, sorry for the current generation, this is a generation, the young people, Generation Z, and the millennials, that will have less money when they're 35 and earn less when they're 35 in real terms, inflation adjusted, than their parents. This is in the history of capitalism since essentially the beginning of the 19th century. This is the first time a generation will be worse off than the previous one. This is unusual, and that leads to tensions. And the tensions will accelerate because the young people, as a percent of the population in the US and in Europe, will grow, and the older generation, the more conservative ones, will contract. So we're going to go into a more state interventionism or system of state intervention, socialism. We're going to go, regardless who wins the election now in 2020.
And your final thoughts, Ira?
Well, I mean, it's, I don't have to, Dr. Farmer lays it out so well. And the problem is that we live in a world, especially where Wall Street is a predominant cheerleader and for what the Fed does. And Farmer, 100% right. Rick Santelli and I have discussed this for more years than I care to remember about that the Fed has successfully destroyed the pricing mechanism of debt. And so I don't know how you do anything. And yes, I know that if we go into a deflationary spiral, which I don't think is going to take place, that's where I separate myself from a lot of other people I think are good thinkers, because they'll just keep throwing at it. And as long as we have Wall Street cheering them on, because why? Because their clients are the people with money, and they have done very well through this. In fact, it was interesting that Chairman Powell yesterday actually addressed this, and we'll have to deal with that at some time. We know that that's, but I don't know when that sometime comes, because every time you want to get there, meaning I think two of the great mistakes made in the last 10 years were Bernanke's taper tantrum response in May of 2013, and then Powell's response to his own self, or as Stanley Druckenmiller calls it, a double shotgun approach of raising rates while shrinking the balance sheet. And then he did the pivot in January of 2019. So it shows you that the Fed is afraid of itself, because it can't get on that path of exiting. And if you don't have an exit strategy, why do I want to stay in your asset class? Listen, I'm a trader, so I'll trade through it. But when I look out on a longer horizon, the only thing you can do is destroy or default. There's just history is replete with it as to what the response would be. And the first response, when they talk about inflation, and now, of course, we're going to have higher inflation than the 2% level that they created. Well, we'll say Don Brash out of Set the Tone, but New Zealand was a far different place in the 80s. We all picked up this mantra. I think it's ridiculous because they're talking, we're going to smooth it out. So now it becomes a stochastic event. Yeah, I just don't see anything well for it. And yes, bondholders who own bonds at the beginning of the year or at the end of last year, if I had the 25% profits made on the long end, I would be getting out as fast as I can and looking for other things. Because I just, unless you really think we're going into a depression, and I know the arguments about the debt overhang and all the things, but I just don't see that taking place because banks that are in a different historical spot. So I proceed everything with caution as I'm building somewhat inflation, as I've talked about several times, Richard, and Dr. Fowler and I talked about it last time. Yep. I'm buying grain companies. I'm buying high quality mining companies all who don't have a lot of debt or can cover their debt pretty easily. And they're so unloved that to me, that's where the better valuations are. And people say, what about banks? I said, right now, and hey, I want to hear Dr. Farber's, the only bank I want to own is UBS because I think they're going back and stop trying to be a Goldman Sachs type entity and are back to managing money. And everything I see in Asia, in the Middle East, UBS has a gigantic footprint. So that one I like, and and Axel Weber is one of my favorite bankers and maybe the best of them all in the world. So it gives me some strength there. But that's the way I'm looking at the world right now.
Well, great. It's been an insightful discussion. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Dr. Farber?
Well, I have a website, gloomboomdoom.com. Gloom, boom, doom, all in one word.
Yep. And Ira?
I'm back. So I wrote a Notes from Underground last. I'll have to start sending. Richard, you'll have to give me Dr. Faber's email. So I'll send it so we can actually start some communication because I've been a fan of his. I've been trading since 1977 after I decided it wasn't smart to get a PhD. Because there were no jobs because of the Vietnam War. Oh, and let me add just one thing. So I write Notes from Underground in a tribute to the great Dostoevsky and the war against the model builder and rationalists. But Dr. Faber makes a great point, and it's a point which is why I oppose the MMT crowd, because when you really cut through it, there's not a war that can't be fought if you practice MMT. Because I can finance anything. I mean, this is Lyndon Johnson's guns and butter, but on steroids.
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, I'm an anti-military person. I have a sense that my father is too.
I don't like the noise of guns.
Right. Yes, to say the least. But I always believe that military spending is very inflationary anyway, because you just keep throwing money and it's not anything we can consume, although through destruction you can consume it. But
they usually build the wrong weapons anyway. But yeah. One thing I was interested, because I also like grain companies, but which ones do you think are the best to own?
I like Bunge, and you and I talked about Bunge last time, because of their massive footprint in South America.
And I also own Bunge.
And they've all been terribly managed, but Archer Daniels probably looks the best it's looked, I don't know, in 25 years. The chart looks pretty good. And you know, I'm just, I go back and I look at their debt levels, and right now, because they had, you know, they're like telecoms. When they have too much money, they do stupid things, and they go out and buy things and purchase things and pay too much for it. So if they keep low here, I think that they'll be in very good position. They're making money, and if grain prices do what I think they're going to do, I think they'll have a very robust year. I like Freeport-McNamara because it covers some areas, but there's been another company that has been terribly managed. I had owned American Barrick, but I really got out of here at the highs because I had enough exposure to the gold. But those are the types of companies I'm looking at. I love Glencore. And now Glencore isn't beloved because they cut their dividend this year. But I like firms that cut their dividend when they're when they know they need to pay down debt. And that's what Glencore did. So next year, I think they'll reinstate the dividend and everybody will come running for it. Those are my favorites, Agrofaber. I mean,
yeah, I also like Freeport. I also have a position. And then I have some gold shares and Bunge. And I own some plantation companies here in Asia. But in general, I think that the resource-based companies, also Rio and BHP and so forth, they're underappreciated by the market in the sense that they're out of favor. Nobody pays much attention to them. But I think once people realize that the recipe to higher interest rates by central banks will be to print even more. There will be a rush into resource-based companies, especially the grains, because one thing that could really upset the world are food shortages.
Yeah, yeah.
Which could happen. Okay. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you. This is a great pleasure. Thank you, Dr.
Yeah. Okay, you. Bye-bye.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.